I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to catch up with Indiana author Mark Tabb, who has a new book out today. It is called Convicted, A Crooked Cop, An Innocent Man, and An Unlikely Journey of Forgiveness and Friendship. We're going to talk about what the book is about and how it came to be. Please join the conversation. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimitswfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today with an old friend of the program, Indiana author Mark Tabb. He's got a new book that is releasing just today. It's nonfiction, and it's called Convicted, A Crooked Cop, An Innocent Man, and An Unlikely Journey of Forgiveness and Friendship. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimitswfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Mark, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, John.
It's good to have you here. Talk to me a little bit. I always ask writers this. Give me a snapshot of the book. I want you to give enough so that people know what it is about, but not so much that they don't have to read it, because it is a worthwhile.
Yeah, this is one I've written, I think, 35, 34 books. I don't know. I've lost track, which this was one, as soon as I heard the story, I said, I've got to be involved in this.
Yeah.
And so it takes place in Benton Harbor, Michigan. Mm-hmm. Young man. I was walking out of a store. He's black. Man comes up to him, says to him, "Where's the dope?" I said, "I don't have any dope." He'd been in the store buying milk for his infant son that he was getting ready to meet for the first time. And the guy says, "You know what I mean? Where's the dope?" The white man then identifies himself as a policeman. And Jamel, the black man, he says, "I got to go. I don't have time for this." Long story short, the policeman lies, fabricates evidence, and Jamel was sentenced to 10 years in a federal prison for possession of crack cocaine with intention to distribute. He had no drugs on him. He had gotten a ride with somebody that is a friend of a cousin to the store to be able to buy some stuff, and then that man had some drugs in his car, but there was nothing connecting it to Jamel. And yet this policeman made sure that there was and sent him to prison for 10 years. When Jamel was innocent, when he landed in that federal prison, his life, for all intents and purposes, was over. And he had one goal in mind, one thing he was going to do. You see, when he saw that cop again, if he ever did, he was going to kill him. Fast forward to today, these two men, I've spent a lot of time with them. I wanted to see if this was for real, what I had heard, and it was. These two men are best friends. They spend a lot of time together, and they travel around the country talking about reconciliation and forgiveness across racial lines, across just on the biggest hurt you can imagine. And so this story is about how you can go from that introduction where they first met one another to where they are today, and it is an unbelievable story.
How did you come across it? How did you find it?
Well, I have a friend, a man named Wes Yoder. He is an agent. I used to work with him a lot. It's the same man who came to me more than 10 years ago, who said, "I've got a story that took place in Indiana. I think you'd be really the perfect person to write it." And it was about a van accident that involved students from Taylor University, and that became Mistaken Identity, which was the number one New York Times bestseller. So he contacted me last summer, I believe it was, and said, here's a link. And it was a story, it was a film report from CBS News, and where a guy from CBS News was in Benton Harbor and interviewed these two guys and said, watch this. I think it's going to be a great book. Want to be involved. I watched the video and I said, I don't care what it takes. I want to be in this book.
Were these guys, you're actually listed in the smaller type here. The two guys.
Yes.
Jamel McGee and Andrew Collins, right?
Yes.
Are listed as the authors.
Yes.
And as usual, it's with Mark Tabb,
yeah.
Although my guess is they did a lot of talking and you did the writing.
They did a lot of talking, yes.
Yeah. Were they looking to do a book at that time, or did you have to go talk them into it?
Well, Wes saw the story on CBS News. And the story on CBS News, they have on Fridays, I cannot remember the reporter's name, he just travels around the country looking for great stories.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody told him about these two guys who worked in a coffee shop in Benton Harbor, Michigan, that he needed to go and talk to. And so that's how he found them. Wes Yoder, my friend, saw the report on CBS News, and he contacted these guys, and he says, you guys have a story to tell. And they had, at that point, had already had accepted a few invitations. Their story had gotten out. Some churches up in Michigan, northern Indiana, had heard about them and had them come and speak. And so Wes contacted them, and they'd never thought about a book before until Wes contacted them. And then he contacted me, and the four of us met together at a restaurant in Benton Harbor and sat down and talked. And that's when we said, yep, we're going forward. We're going to do this.
Yeah, it seems to me that you've got the two main characters here,
mm-hmm.
Andrew and Jamel. But there are other characters besides this, but the tangible one is also the town of Benton,
yes,
Harbor. Because it is, Benton Harbor comes across almost as a microcosm of the kind of divisions that plague the country,
yeah,
right now. For those people who are listening who don't know Benton Harbor, could you sort of put it in a thumbnail as well?
Okay. And to talk about Benton Harbor, you have to talk about St. Joseph as well. These two towns, and there's a river that goes in between them, but we're here on Meridian Street. It'd be like, one side of Meridian is Benton Harbor, the other side is St. Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
But the contrast between the two sides of that river could not be stronger. St. Joseph is over 95% white. It is a tourist destination. The lakefront beaches are all manicured, beautiful. My wife and I, we were just up there last week. It's a tourist area, lots of shops, a very quaint downtown. It's a place to go. You cross the bridge into Benton Harbor. Benton Harbor is 95% black. Benton Harbor, the streets are filled with potholes. The unemployment rate between St. Joseph and Benton Harbor, in Benton Harbor, I think it's more than double. I know the median income in Benton Harbor is less than half of what it is in St. Joseph. I spent time in St. Joseph or in Benton Harbor, and really, the one place, and I mentioned this in the prologue to the book, that kind of sums things up, is the first day I was with Andrew and Jamel, they wanted to show me where different parts of their story took place. So the very opening of the book takes place in a park on Broadway Street.
Hmm.
So we went over there, and they were going to show me, because this is where they got reunited 4 years after the initial arrest, and it was not a pleasant reunion. And so we go in there, and the first thing I noticed was there was we call it a berry hydrant, a water hydrant. And it was leaning at about at a nice little angle where it's leaning out. And in the middle of it, there was some tape that had been wrapped around. And through the tape, water was just squirting out. And I asked him, I said, so how long has this been leaking? And Jamel and Andrew both, they kind of laughed. They said, it's always been leaking. They said it leaks 12 months out of the year. It never stops. And people in the area, they tried to get the city to fix it, but the city would never fix it. I went online to check because I used to work in a plumbing supply warehouse when I was a teenager. And I've installed those things before. $50 is what it would cost to repair that. Mm. But it just sits there and it runs 12 months out of the year. In the summertime, it's a swamp. In the wintertime, it's a skating rink. And people have just given up anything ever happening. That is basically the kind of hopelessness you have in Benton Harbor. High unemployment, people just sit down on their front porches. But more than that, there's been race riots in Benton Harbor The first one was back in the 60s when George Romney was governor of Minnesota. Michigan, I mean. Yes.
Mitt's father.
And they called in the National Guard. One of the dynamics of Benton Harbor I'd never seen before is that state highway patrolmen, state policemen, patrol the residential streets of this town of 12,000 to 13,000 people. And when you're there, you see the police, you see the just the conditions of the streets, and really you feel a sense of just kind of people have given up. And it is it's unlike any place I had ever been before.
It is, and you know, in so many ways, as I was reading this, and I should say, it is written as a story, not a polemic or anything like that. But it's impossible to read it without the thinking of, you know, the divides, the assumptions, at least part of Andrew's problem. I don't think I'm giving anything away here. He is the crooked cop.
Yeah.
His problem is that even without consciously, there is a point where he crosses the moral line and starts doing things simply for to enrich himself and all of that. But at least initially, part of the problem is that he's doing things because he operates from an assumption of guilt.
Yes.
Other party that, you know, he takes a look and assumes, okay, you know, you have to be guilty, so therefore I'm within my rights and I'm doing the right thing if I make that case, even if the evidence is not there. It is that sort of culture of suspicion, of conviction that the other is somehow evil that intrigued me, that comes out as a subtext in the book. Was that intentional?
That is, because that's, you know, I'm white. I've never been pulled over because of driving while white. Mm-hmm. And I wish we could say that this has been Benton Harbor's an isolated incident, but it's not. I mean, driving while black, being pulled over, is something that's happened to my son-in-law, who is black. My youngest daughter, when I was working on this book, my two youngest daughters are adopted from Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. So my youngest daughter, she was driving to school. She called me, told me she got pulled over. Then she told me what had happened. It was a police car. She was driving the speed limit on Highway 40 here in Indiana. A police car pulled up beside her. The policeman looked at her. Then he slowed down, came up behind her, and it started getting closer and closer and closer, tailgating her until she sped up. And as soon as she sped up a little bit, turned on the lights, pulled her over, gave her a warning. I can't remember what he said he was looking for, and sent her on her way. I immediately called Andrew Collins because I was in the middle of working on this book. I said, Andrew, here's what just happened. You think she got pulled over just because of the color of her skin? He goes, absolutely. He said, that's what we would do. We just assume guilt based on how somebody looks. And that is, in this book, as I'm writing, you know, because I write as Jamel, I have to see the world through his eyes. And it just horrified me. Because this is something that, I mean, it's on the news every single day. And it's not just Benton Harbor, Michigan, but it takes place all over the country. And it's, I think part of it is an outgrowth of the war on drugs, which is, there's more that we could talk about on that. But it's, it really, the interaction between the black community and a police department is really the fault line, I believe, in the tension, the racial tension that is underlying so much in our country that we hope we'd be past, but we're not.
Well, we can see that. That's part of, as I read it, I thought, okay, we now live in a post-Ferguson, all of those incidents world now. And I thought, okay, and that's not what this story is ultimately.
No.
But it does speak to the kind of mindset. And it's not just all the police. There's some hostility. There's some deep suspicion on the other side as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It goes both ways. And that's part of what attracted me to the story is because it is not just about that, but there's those assumptions that are there. And especially in a place like Benton Harbor, where there's been so much tension for so long, for decades, there's just an assumption of guilt on one side and an assumption of I cannot trust these people on the other side. And that really cuts through and causes a lot of, you know, the story would not have happened without those kinds of assumptions.
We are talking with Indiana author Mark Tabb. His new book, a nonfiction work called Convicted, A Crooked Cop, An Innocent Man, and An Unlikely Journey of Forgiveness and Friendship, has just been released today. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking with Indiana author Mark Tabb about his just released new nonfiction book, Convicted, A Crooked Cop, An Innocent Man, and An Unlikely Journey of Forgiveness and Friendship. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Rob has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Rob, welcome to the program.
Hello. I hope you can hear me.
Yes.
I had a couple of comments. One, I wonder about this friendship. It sounds like Stockholm Syndrome to me, where somebody's been subjected to a horrible psychological experience, and they identify with the perpetrator. Number two, this sounds like a feel-good book, and those are good, but all I see is one life is ruined while the other life goes on as if nothing happens. Certainly doesn't seem equitable. And three, lastly, to the author, this started way before the war on drugs. This started with slavery, and we can't ignore that. These kinds of police perpetrator episodes have been going on way before the war on drugs in the 80s. And I can attest to that because it happened regularly in the south side of Chicago where I grew up. I'll sign off and listen.
All right. Thanks very much for the call and for making your points, Rob. And to be fair here, I probably ought to say, because I set up the question, we have only told one half of the story, which
right.
is Jamel's. Probably need to say that Andrew suffers consequences. He ends
yes.
up in prison as well
yes.
For being a dirty cop. I mean, there's no other way.
Yeah.
There's a laundry list of things that he did.
Yes.
But for being a dirty cop, and to some degree, I hesitate because I don't want to give all of this away, their reconciliation comes out of an attempt to make restitution,
yes.
basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that fair without giving
yes.
too many of the details away?
Exactly. And on the caller and the three points you made, on the last point, absolutely, you're correct. This predates the war on drugs. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book, is to address those very issues. But on your first point, you said it sounds like Stockholm Syndrome. That is not at all the case. These two men, both of whom suffered consequences. When Andrew was caught and was convicted, that's when Jamel, he was released from prison. But even before that happened, Jamel had to work through this anger that's inside of him that was just destroying him. And he had to find a way to be able to work through that. He never wanted to see this cop again. He didn't matter to him if he ever saw him again or not. He didn't seek out a friendship. But just so he could live with himself and so this would not destroy him. So it was not a Stockholm Syndrome at all. Whenever they do meet again later on in the book, and it was more than 10 years after the initial events had taken place, it's a genuine friendship that arose. And as far as being one-sided, both men, their lives were dramatically altered. Andrew lost everything and should have. I mean, and by his own admission, I mean, he's owned up to what he has done. He's owned it. He has, I mean, the time I spent with him, I think he, when he would find out something, some aspect of the story, something that he had done to Jamel that he didn't know before. I mean, he was just broken over it. He was doing everything he could, just trying to make restitution to try to set things right. And so it's a really, I mean, it's a story that shows the power of forgiveness and how what it does take to move beyond where we have been in the past, the change of heart that has to take place, and the change of perspective and seeing things through another man's eyes.
What's interesting, I mean, and I guess I can ask this, because the focus is on Andrew and Jamel, and we've talked a bit about Jamel already, is there's no other way to say this. Jamel is not the only one that Andrew did wrong to.
No. No, there
was... And has he, you know, has he tried to make restitution or reconcile with the other people whose lives he damaged?
Yes, very much so. That's he stayed in the area for that very reason. And a lot of those reconciliation times have not been, our attempts have not been well received. Some have been. But I think the fact that he has made no excuses for what he has done and has completely owned it, I mean, that's the first step toward being able to have any kind of reconciliation. And he's, I mean, and it's not something, it's genuine. And like I said, he lost nearly everything. The only thing he did not lose through this was he did not lose his wife and family because his wife made the decision to stick with him. And she could have easily walked away.
So talk me through... because there are parts of this that are pretty raw.
Yes.
I mean, you can tell these guys are going back to points in their lives that most of us wouldn't want to revisit if we'd made it through to the other side in some fashion. When you first approached them or talked with them, what was that encounter like? And what questions did they have of you?
Well, that's very interesting. They... when we first met, they had already told a large part of their story in other settings. They, you know, speaking engagement, questions and answers, and they had been very, very honest with about what had gone on. So when we met with them, one of their biggest questions was Jamel's was a huge fan of the movie Concussion. And so his first question was, what is Dr. Bennett Omalu like? Because I had just finished, when I started their book, I had just finished writing Dr. Bennett Omalu's book. And that's all Jamel wanted to talk about. And the fact that I knew Dr. Omalu and he had such great respect for him, he immediately then trusted me and said, all right, I'll share whatever we needed to share. And there's parts of the story that we did not include. I mean, there's... for the sake of space, Andrew's experience in prison was really cut short. And then also some of the things that happened to Jamel after he was out of prison, after he got his life back and an injury that took place, and he ended up homeless for a while. And we didn't – originally I'd expanded that, but we had to – for the sake of space, had to be shrunk down. But so there's part of that, and he's very honest about what he'd gone through.
Were you limited because, and again, I don't think this gives anything away, the story is told in alternating voices here where, you know, Jamel speaks, then Andrew speaks, and the events march together, you know, as they're moving toward, and in some ways the story is told a little bit cinematically in terms of flashback. You start out with the point where they come back together, pull away from that before we know exactly how things work out, and then take us back to sort of the beginning of the moments that brought them together. Did that limit you in any way, using that format? Were there parts that, because you had to write in one voice and then the other, and sometimes making their lives march in lockstep had to have been a little tough, I would think, to manage the material.
Because I needed to keep, a couple of concerns. One is the story needed to keep moving. The book needed to keep moving to play out, to keep the reader involved. There's places we could have gone that really had nothing to do with the overall story, that we could have gone there and explored that for a while. But I'm a voracious reader, and I knew if I do that, I'm gonna lose the hold of the story. I wanted people to just keep saying what's going to happen next as it involves these two men. So there was that, and then I did need to keep things even as far as how much there was to tell and how much, you know, the tales. And so, you know, there were some parts of the story where one of them would give me way more detail than the other, and I'd have to try to draw more out. And so, but it, so I'd had to try to balance it out. But in terms of, you know, of what I wanted to put into the book, everything is there. Mm-hmm. Everything is there. I just think that, you know, a couple things, the takeaways I wanted for the reader. One was to see the power of forgiveness and the transforming power of that, and how it sets us free on the inside, and then it can bring about relationships and friendships that we never thought were possible. Another thing I wanted people to do is I wanted them to be angry. I wanted to show the system for what it is, because, you know, Jamel, he ended up did not serve the full 10 years he was given, but he was given a maximum sentence because he refused to do a plea deal. He wasn't going to do a plea deal. He was innocent, but nobody would listen to him. And so because he had the audacity to want a full trial and to have his day in court and to presumably be innocent until proven guilty, but that's one of the things that we find, especially in these kind of cases, is that now the burden of proof of innocence lays upon the accused, not upon the criminal justice system. And so I want the reader to see that and to feel some outrage, because I was outraged. There were things I wanted to say that we didn't, because I didn't want my outrage to just, you know, start screaming through there, because I knew that wouldn't do any good.
Whose voice was harder to capture in the writing, Andrew's or Jamel's? Because you can tell, even without the headings, I mean, I could tell after I fell into it, who's talking now and who's not.
You know, I think they were about the same. It was just, the hardest part for me was, I don't think it was hard, but like everything that's from the trial, from Jamel's trial, and also from Andrew's sentencing, all of that comes from transcripts from the from the courts. And so each of them would give me their account of what took place, and then I got the transcripts from the court, and there was some, you know, there was some deviation just from memory. Like, there were some things that Andrew thought, you know, that signals he picked up from the judge that was kind of like a wink and a nod. It doesn't come across in the transcript. And so there was just, you know, having to balance it out and make sure, okay, everything is exactly the way that the court reporter says it was. And there were some things that took place out beyond that, and I had to be very careful of how we worded that.
If you want to join the conversation, we're talking with Indiana author Mark Tabb about his new book, Convicted, A Crooked Cop, An Innocent Man, and An Unlikely Journey of Forgiveness and Friendship, that is just out today. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can send us an email, as a listener named Barb has done. Our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Barb writes, I heard the speaker say his daughter was pulled over on Highway 30. She's got question mark for 40. Driving while black, 40. Mm-hmm. Actually, what happened to her is exactly what happened to my white mother while driving in northern Indiana. It was dark. A car began tailgating her. She sped up. The car sped up closer. She sped up a little more, and he switched on his lights to pull her over. That was probably 30 years ago. I told her that she should never speed up and go over the speed limit because of a tailgater. She should just put on her flashers, and the driver will usually back off. That gets to, and I don't want to wade into this, but one of the contentions is that, of driving while black is that they will find. And in the book, Andrew talks about all of the tricks that that unscrupulous police officers will use to create probable cause,
right,
pretending they can't see the license plate number, you know, all of that. What is, you know, the person who had, I think, the larger burden of forgiveness here was Jamel.
Absolutely.
Clearly. How did he get to that point? And are there times he still sways? You know, we tend to think, oh, forgiveness, and once it's done, it's over with.
No.
I mean, it's a daily struggle.
Right. It was about, and one thing I do want to say, because I mentioned a story from the reader, the email that came in, is I'm sharing stories. I'm not trying to paint with a broad brush and say this is what all police departments are like, but these are just things that happen. These are things that happen. I know it's embarrassing to police departments as well, but these are things that happen. But, yeah, the heavier burden of forgiveness was on Jamel, and he came to that point. If I tell too much of the story, we'll give away part of the book, but that is really it took place when he went to prison. Like I said, all he wanted to do was he wanted to exact revenge. Mm-hmm. And he had that anger that was just burning up inside of him. And so when he gets there, gets into prison, he would have, it happened, we just have a few of the instances that are in the book, where somebody would start pushing him, another inmate, just start pushing and pushing. And he just wanted to be left alone. And so he would, you know, look at the guy and say, you really want to do this? You really want this? Yeah, I want this. All right, let's go. And he told me, he said, the first punch, he'd get in a fight, he said, and Jamel's a man who can take care of himself in a fight. And he said,
he'd been trained as a boxer.
He had been trained as a boxer, yeah. And he grew up on some, in just rough, rough streets, lots of gangs where he just had to be able to survive. He always said the first punch was self-defense. The rest of those punches, it was Andrew Collins. It was a dress rehearsal for what he was going to do to Andrew. And so what he found was after one of those fights took place and he had to have some friends who drug him off of this other guy, that he kind of stood back and looked at what he was becoming and he just was horrified. And so it was really, it was a point where he had to just, and then he found a Gideon's Bible that had been in his cell for 3 years. He'd never noticed it. And he picked it up and he started reading. And that's when he had this wrestling match, the biggest fight of his life going on, of choosing to let go of that anger and let go of that hate and choosing to forgive, not because he was going to overlook what had been done to him, but because he knew if he holds on to this hate and this anger, it's going to destroy him and turn him into somebody that he did not want to be.
Did he ever feel like there was a chance that he was slipping back?
Yeah, the book opens up with the number one episode where they meet for the first time after both of them were out of prison. They hadn't seen each other since the courtroom where Andrew testified against him. And Jamel walks up, and it's this huge block party, and the crowd parts like the Red Sea because he is a man with a mission. And he walks up, and he's just that anger and that fire is inside, and he figures, this is my chance. He grabs Andrew by the hand. You know, Andrew reaches out to shake his hand, and Jamel takes it and starts squeezing and says, do you remember who I am? Or do you know who I am? Mm-hmm. And right there, it was, he didn't know which way it was going to go.
In Andrew's piece of this, given what he has done, often the person who, you know, who has to accept the forgiveness has the heavier burden because you got to let go of the fact, okay, I did wrong to this person, and that's always there, but I did wrong. How difficult was that process for him?
Well, when we were together, and
Tell you what, why don't we hold that?
Okay,
we'll pick it up on the other side because I think it's going to be complicated.
Yeah.
Story. We are talking with Indiana author Mark Tabb about his just released book, Convicted, A Crooked Cop, An Innocent Man, and An Unlikely Journey of Forgiveness and Friendship. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Again, we are talking with Mark Tabb about his new book, Convicted, A Crooked Cop, An Innocent Man, and An Unlikely Journey of Forgiveness and Friendship. Please stay with us.
Hello, I'm...
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today with Indiana author Mark Tabb. He has a new book out, just released today, called Convicted, A Crooked Cop, An Innocent Man, and An Unlikely Journey of Forgiveness and Friendship. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. I asked you a question beforehand about how Andrew Collins, who is one of the people in the book, dealt with the part of having to forgive and work through this reconciliation. Rather than have you answer it, I think we'll actually let the man himself, Andrew Collins, has just called in. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. How are you?
We're doing well. So it's not often we get people just to walk off the page onto the air with us. So thank you very much for calling in. So I want to talk with you a little bit. I mean, what was that process like for you? Because it was one thing to have Jamel forgive you. It's yet another thing to forgive yourself.
Yeah, and that's when we have speaking engagements, that's what we run into, is people will come to Jamel after the speaking engagement and say, hey, this person's wronged me. How do I forgive them? And then I'll have the people that come to me and say, hey, I've done some messed up stuff, but you, you are something else. And they used to hurt my feelings a little bit, but then I understood that vulnerability gives birth to vulnerability. And when I'm able to share candidly about who I used to be, it opens the door for people to open up to what they've done to other people. So there's still moments where shame washes over me, and I have to just remind myself I'm a new person. And if I still owe somebody an apology, I will seek them out and apologize to them. And Jamel, we go through different seasons where I'll have a revelation of how badly I wounded him, and I'll apologize again, and then he just smiles at me and shakes his head and tells me to shut up. So
let me ask this. Well, I've got several questions for you here. The first, I guess, would be, could you talk a little bit about that transition? You know, it's one thing for you to shake hands and agree to forgive transgressions and all of that. It's yet another thing to develop a friendship out of that. What was the process, and what is the source of that friendship, that tie that the two of you have?
Yeah, I would say that it's a lot of common threads in our lives. It's a common faith. We both know that we've been forgiven by God, and you know, Jamel will tell you know, if I've been forgiven by God for the wrong things I've done, who am I to hold it against another person? I give him so much credit for that, because forgiveness is one thing, but to be a friend with a person who wronged you like that's another. So I think we see the common threads in our life, and you'll read that in Convicted, that we grew up so differently, but we have a lot of the same background. And then we just started we've articulated it now that we see each other as a human first. We see each other as a man first. And as a man, you know, how do you feel about this thing? How do you walk through life? And just as a man, he's just an awesome person. And I would hope he thinks that I'm decent as well, because we spend a lot of time together. But then you can go beyond that and say, okay, now that I see you from just a purely humanity point of view, now let's go a little deeper. How do you see this event in society as a black man in America? And he'll ask me, how do you see this event as somebody who used to be a police officer? So it's at its core seeing each other as a man first, and then being able to peel back the layers of how we both grew up.
We've got a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, who says she wants to know how the two men got to a place of not fearing and no anger. She says she's fearful and angry of the people who behave threateningly to her and not forgiving. So is there counsel, Andrew, that you could give this woman about how she gets past that place of fear?
Yeah, I mean, aside from a belief in something higher than yourself, I don't know that you can get past the fear factor. Because if this life is all we have offered to us, then that's a lot to be fearful for. And, you know, when I walked back into the city of Benton Harbor, I knew that I had been called back there to be reconciled. And when people would say things like, you're stupid and you need to leave there and never look back, I just felt this peace that if I'm doing the right thing and if I'm doing what I feel God called me to, that he will protect me through it. And I've just seen that so many times. I mean, I was lodged in a halfway house in the city of Benton Harbor on a clerical mistake when I was leaving prison. I wasn't supposed to be in Benton Harbor. I was in there with guys I sent to prison, and they were on their way back. So I think if you don't have any faith system at all in your life, it's going to be hard to walk through life without fear.
How much, and I'm going to ask this too also, because this book, because it is written in your voice and in Jamel's voice, means that the two of you had to talk about some pretty intimate things.
Yeah.
How difficult was it to share that? Because you didn't know Mark at all before this process started, right?
No. As far as sharing with Mark, he's such a kind and gentle soul that it was just like talking to a friend. And for me, much of sharing my story is almost like telling somebody else's story, because there's been such a dramatic change in my life because of what God has done, that I have to remind myself sometimes, like, I used to be that awful person. I used to be that evil individual. But there was times where I heard Jamel share things where Mark had to pull it out of him, because I think Jamel was protecting me from what he had felt when he was locked up for all those years. And when I heard the anger and just that rage that came out in Jamel when he really opened up and told the truth about what he felt, I was taken back and was just blown away again at Jamel's grace for me, because he had protected me for so many months by not sharing those things with me. And he wouldn't have had it not been for Mark pulling those things out of him. There was a couple times where Mark was like, Jamel, this was a traumatic time in your life. Like, you're sitting across the table smiling at me, telling me this story. And it's just because Jamel is so full of joy right now. And I think to some degree he didn't want to go back to that place, mm-hmm. because that's a hard place that he had to live. So those are the things that surprised me in sharing our story.
Mark, you wanted to jump in.
Well, my favorite point, Andrew, there was one day where I met with Jamel in the morning and you in the evening. And one of my favorite moments, I tell the story, was that evening. I remember I asked you, I said, so Andrew, did Jamel ever tell you how he planned to kill you when that's all he wanted to do? And you kind of paused and you kind of sat back in the chair and you said, no. And I said, well, he told me that.
Was that knowledge, Andrew, you really wanted, too, is another yeah. question.
And I said, well, he wasn't going to use a gun or a knife or anything like that, but he was going to beat you until you were dead. And you looked at me, because we both know he's a powerful man and he could have, and you just went, whoa. And, you know, it was, but now knowing Jamel, to hear that story in the time I spent with him, it's like there's no way that matches up to this man I've gotten to know, because this is a man who there's a lightness about him. He's not carrying around that kind of burden anymore. It seems as unlikely for him to be that kind of violent person. I mean, I just it'd be like my walking into my little brown dachshund suddenly becoming this vile, rabid dog. I mean, it's you know, he is just such a gentle man that I could never see that. But that was one of those moments where, and also then one of the things that struck me was the entire time we're together, I cannot count how many times you apologized again to Jamel. There'd be some you say, dude, I never knew this. I'm so sorry. And he would just, again, like you said, he just smiles, say, like, man, quit apologizing. You know, God's got this.
Well, there were parts, Andrew, if I could jump in, it sounds like there were parts of Jamel's story, even out of this process of writing the book, that came as revelations mm-hmm. to you that you had not known before. Which of those was the most painful for you to hear? Because it does sound like a lot of this, even though you are good friends and all, there were parts of your stories that you had not shared with each other until you participated together in this book.
Yeah, when Jamel was sharing about how he had no support from his family, I thought about, you know, the support that I got when I got out of prison, and it was still a tough road and it was still a tough walk, and there was still a lot of work for me to be to put in, but Jamel had none of that, no support whatsoever. And it was because they still thought he was a drug dealer. They still believed my lies until I came forward and told the truth. And I came to this point one night as we were talking with Mark that I just kind of broke down a little bit. And I said, you know, Jamel, I didn't just take your freedom away. I took your voice away. And it was the first time I had that revelation that I wasn't only locking up people physically, but I was taking away their voice in many instances. And I can't even imagine the helplessness that he must have felt in that time.
Mark, what were there parts, because it's not an easy story at times to read. Were there parts that were difficult for you to hear?
I think there were many times when Andrew was telling me his story, and I just look at him and say, I was just shaking my head, and I was like, you were a bad man. You know, I would feel myself becoming angry at the person that he had become, or that he had once been. And, you know, but it's, I think the parts that made me most angry, had to do with the court system and the judge. I want to take a copy of this book and shove it at that judge, but I don't know if it'd do any good. But, you know, that assumption of guilt that he had as he looks at this man who's standing across from him proclaiming his innocence, and he just assumes he's guilty and is annoyed that this guy is protesting his innocence, absolutely made me furious. And that was, it was hard for me to do my job and to write the way that I needed to write and really capture the hurt that was in Jamel through that. But I just, that's something I haven't been able to really get over.
We've got a Facebook question from a listener named Gary. And again, if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Gary really wants to ask questions about how much of the book addresses things like income inequality. What he's asking really is the need of the innocent man to get a ride from someone, and additionally, what role maybe those differences, the poverty and all of that, played in Andrew's descent into corruption. Mark, I'll give you the first crack at that, then okay. I want to hear Andrew's thoughts.
Well, both these guys, it's one of the things that has helped, I mean, it really built their friendship. As they began to get to know one another, they discovered that there are some real similarities in their background and their stories growing up and how they grew up. As far as the income inequality, Jamel did not have to get a ride because he didn't have a car. It's because he had unpaid speeding tickets.
Yeah.
And his license, he had just been pulled over that morning and let off with a warning on that one. And so he had to go pay the tickets, and he had the money to pay them. He just hadn't messed with them yet. And he was actually getting ready as soon as the spring started. He was getting ready to open his own business. But as far as income inequality, that's part of the background of the overall story, because it takes place in Benton Harbor, which is a very poor community and a community with very, very limited opportunities. And Andrew, you know the town so much more than me. I just know from what you guys have told me in the little bit of time I've spent there, but you've lived there and you live there now. And so you could probably address this better than me.
Well, and it's also, it's been the subject of a book about 20 years ago.
Yes.
That I know you cite Alex Kotlowitz's The Other Side of the River, which mm-hmm. was sort of just an examination of the dichotomy in American life. How much of economic pressure, we talked earlier in the program, Mark and I did, Andrew, about how initially you started just from a point of assuming guilt with people, but there was a descent. We crossed a line and actually started looking at opportunities for personal profit as well.
Yeah, and I mean, that can, that's a bit of a symptom of the economical differences between St. Joe and Benton Harbor. And I always want to give a precursor that whenever I share any of this, I'm not making an excuse for what I did. Mm-hmm. None of what I'm about to share excuses what I did. I was an awful person. I did awful things. But I had convinced myself, because St. Joe police officers were paid so much higher than Benton Harbor officers, and because we did so much more work you know, air quotations, than what they did. It was okay for me to skim off the top. It was okay for, you know, I started to justify my actions. I started to minimize my actions. I saw a poor department, Benton Harbor, that was thrilled with this drug forfeiture money that was coming in that we could spend. We were supposed to spend it on law enforcement towards drugs, but we were spending it on basketball courts for community development, on computers for school resource officers. Again, all good things. But they weren't being used appropriately. So I started saying, well, if they're not using it appropriately, I won't use it appropriately. And it was just the slippery slope that got completely out of control. And a big part of my justification for that was I didn't get paid what I deserved to get paid. I seized more money every year than what I was paid. And I saw it as, well, if I'm going to pay for my own position, I might as well take off the top.
We're getting close on time here, Andrew, but I want to ask, because it is you obviously were talking about some painful stuff here. Was participating in the book a therapeutic experience or a painful one, or both?
Yeah, I think it was both. I mean, anytime you step into confession, it's going to be both. It's going to be painful at the moment, but the relief that God gives you through it is worth the pain. Being able to get that stuff outside of yourself, you gain a little bit more of yourself back. Has been my experience with confession.
So, Mark, tell me a little bit, if people want to find the book, where can they go?
They can go. The easiest place is Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. Just type in their convicted. If they go to my website, which is marktabb.com, M-A-R-K-T-A-B-B, as soon as they get there, there'll be the cover of the book is right there, and an order now button that you can push. Different bookstores will have it, but I find that the easiest way, the bookstore that will never sell out, is Amazon, and they'll have it within a day or two.
MarkTabb.com, too. Are you guys doing any signings here in the area together or appearances?
Yeah, we'll be in Indianapolis October 22nd.
Okay.
At Resonate Church. We'll be doing something with Mark here in the near future, mm-hmm. at the church that he's a part of. And then we'll also be up here in the St. Joseph, Michigan area. We'll be at First Church of God in St. Joe on October 1st.
Well, that sounds like an appropriate last word here. I would like to thank both of my guests, the one who was scheduled and the one who was a lovely surprise guest, Mark Tabb and Andrew Collins. We've been talking about their nonfiction book, Convicted, A Crooked Cop, An Innocent Man, and An Unlikely Journey of Forgiveness and Friendship. I'd like to thank you both for what has been an enlightening conversation.
Thank you, John. Appreciate you having me on.
Oh, certainly. And I'd also like to thank our listeners for some great questions and for hanging in there. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.
We'll be right back.